What's up, guys? It's Mark here, back again with another episode, our 10th and final episode of The Sensory Corner, a podcast surrounding all things sensory, parenting, and occupation related. My name is Mark. I'll be your host for today. And this podcast, before I jump into it, actually, has a very special announcement. Yes, this is the finale episode. No, this isn't the last season. We'll be coming out with a new one in the incoming future. However, I want to say that we'll be spending a lot of our time and resources trying to find and partner up with new companies within the sensory space, of whom truly align with our mission and value statement, to truly make the world a much more equitable and accessible place. So, this podcast is not only being brought to you guys by SensoMinds, but our very first partner within the SensoMinds network, Sensational Connections. If you don't know who Sensational Connections is, they're a sensory box based out of the Bay ran by two very talented OTs, OT Amigos and OT Outside of the Box. Those are their Instagram handles. They run by the names of Ivana and Alvin. The reason why we're partnering up with Sensational Connections is because they're not just any old random sensory box filled with random toys and trinkets. No, they're extremely purposeful and very versatile sensory boxes which lend themselves to open-ended play. Alvin and Ivana do a really good job of curating a box which is not only theme-oriented to help give you a better direction on your open-ended play journey with your child, but also they give you guys instructional booklets on how you can think of new ideas and ways to facilitate open-ended play with your child.
So with all that said and done, I think you guys can already guess what this podcast topic will be about. It's about open-ended play. And the reason why we're choosing this is because over the past few weeks, I've seen OT blogs and OT accounts and even mom blogs talking about the benefits behind open-ended play. However, nobody really goes into how exactly do we as parents and professionals enact this in our own practice or in our own homes with our children. And that's a very big part because open-ended play is open-ended, so there really are no rules. So that direction can sometimes be ambiguous. So who else better to talk about this topic than the founders of Sensational Connections, Alvin and Ivana? They'll be talking about what exactly is open-ended play, what constitutes open-ended play, but more so, what are the household items and little toys and trinkets you can find laying around anywhere to be able to facilitate open-ended play with your child? And most importantly, why exactly is it so important to be able to have open-ended play with your child? What are the benefits behind it which will help aid in your child's learning, growth, and development? And most importantly, we'll be talking about how exactly do sensory boxes like Sensational Connections come into play. No pun intended. But anyways, hopefully you guys enjoy this very last episode of this season of The Sensory Corner. It was a blast having you guys on. Hopefully you guys stay tuned for our next season. But anyways, that's enough from me. My name is Mark, and this is The Sensory Corner. Hope you guys enjoy.
Theory of Montessori play, but it's similar to kind of the open-endedness. They want the kids to be able to use these items in a variety of ways, because when there's no face to something, they can use it as a male, they can use it as a female, they can use it as a tree, they can use it in all these different ways. And they want to facilitate that kind of abstract thinking, and they want to facilitate a lot of that open-ended play that a lot of what we're doing.
And I feel like open-ended play is like a broader umbrella under, Montessori is under the open-ended play of umbrella, because like they still, I mean, like we use the wooden peg dolls as well, but I feel like open-ended is more than just the wooden peg dolls and everything looking the same. I mean, it could be like a coin and then you could play it as like a cucumber, you know what I mean? Like it's broader than just no face.
Yeah. So is Montessori just kind of, is it a framework of sorts for open-ended play?
I think so. I would say it's definitely a framework, or I like how Ivana put it in terms of, if we're looking at an umbrella of open-ended play, it's a part of open-ended play, and it's the framework that those schools use particularly.
And I hear it all the time, the fact that play is the occupation of a child. Every single OT loves to drop that. In every single conversation I've had, they've said the main occupation for a kid is play. It's not worksheets. It's not activities on the table. It's literally for them to do whatever they need to do. For you guys as OTs, how exactly do you facilitate that?
Yeah, I think a big part of kind of our caseload is that we have a very moderate to severe behavioral students. So giving them enough structure, such as a sensory box, where they're provided a specific area to work on and specific skills, but giving them that open-ended play, because there's not one way to do it. So giving them various options, various tools, and showing them different ways to use a tool really facilitates that open-endedness and that open-ended my growth mindset of, okay, I can do this, I can problem solve. Within play, you're not only playing, you're trying to create a plan and execute that plan and problem solve what's going wrong. So there's so many ways of diving into it and looking at how you want to go into it. But yeah.
And I think it's structured in a way that, you know, we're presenting the tools that they need to be successful, but there's no right or wrong way to use the tools. And it's structured and designed in a way that the child or the student leads the play so that their creativity could be within it, but there's no right or wrong with the sensory box or open and in play in general.
When children are faced with agnostic tools or toys which look like one another, an example I've heard of is like trains. Within the neurodiverse world, children oftentimes, when they look at trains, they'll take on the role of the train. You know, they'll say choo-choo, and then they'll run it up and down the railroad tracks and all that fun stuff. But sometimes children will just line them up. You know, they just arrange them in one row. And they interact with the toys in a way which may not be typical. So how exactly do you guide a child of whom is within the neurodiverse realm into partaking into that open-ended play?
There's definitely many ways of going at it. But I think, as kind of Ivana was talking about, we want to take their lead. We don't want to kind of derail them in their play. Like, if we're looking at play as kind of a car, the child is driving that car to where they want to do and what they want to play. So you know, you want to kind of take that lead of where they're going. So if they're playing with that train, you can kind of sit there with them and kind of what we like to call parallel play, do what they're doing and take their lead. So maybe we go, we're going to turn. So see if we can kind of facilitate that core, and we're going to kind of turn with the train. Oh, let's move to the left. Let's move to the right. So we want to continue what they're doing, but we don't want to fully change it. We can kind of facilitate similar things that we want to do that are therapeutic goals, but also intertwine and kind of collaborate their idea of play and continue that back and forth conversation of play. Because if they have an idea, we want to bounce on that idea. And then we want it to be a conversation in a way of, oh, let's go back and forth with your idea and my idea. Then that gives them control of what they're doing, and it makes it playful and it makes it therapeutic. And then it gives us a little bit of control of, ooh, let's do this, let's do that, incorporating the more therapeutic benefits that we want to within our sessions.
Yeah, and I think kind of similar to what Alvin said, just expanding, you know, their thoughts and ideas. Like for the train, you know, it could be making a left or a right, but where are we? Are we in the mountains? Are we in a city? And just expanding and those exchange of ideas really is kind of the structure of open-ended play.
Yeah, if we're looking at like the development of play, like real young infants, they're only looking at moving them, their bodies, moving their arms. And then they go on to kind of playing with items single-handedly, or so they're looking for that cause and effect. And then they kind of go to that parallel play. And then they slowly kind of start to maybe watch their, like, associating toys with other people, and they're watching other kids play. So then they're building on those skills. So you want to meet them at that level. You don't want to kind of jump past the next developmental stage of play before anything else. So building on that foundation first and foremost is pretty important for development.
Okay. I've heard this multiple times, the stages of play. Do you guys know what, because you broke it down just now, but are there certain stages which you guys look out for as OTs within your practice? What exactly is the progression of play within a child, and where exactly does open-ended play fit within that whole spectrum?
So I think it really depends on certain literature and whatnot. So okay. I know them based off of, I think, 6 different types of stages of play. Solitary play. So that's when kids are really only interested in playing alone. So they're by themselves playing with the blocks and kind of building on their own. And then they build onto that. It's kind of the onlooker of play. So they might be at the playground watching kids play from a distance. They're not interacting. And then the parallel play. where they may be doing something similar, like playing with cars in that same area, maybe watching here or there, but again, no interaction. And then the next stage after that, you kind of associate the different objects and the people around them. So kids might be playing on the same piece of playground equipment, all by doing the same things, and they're interacting that way. And from there, it kind of goes from the cooperative play, a lot more socialization, okay, a lot more cooperation with others and interaction. So how we look at play as OTs, because that is what you were talking about, it is the main occupation of, of kids. You want to teach them how to socialize. You want to teach them facilitate the gross motor skills required for play. And there are so many underlying areas that impact play that kids think they're playing, but they're really getting therapy.
Definitely. I think, yeah, that's just a little side note. I've heard countless times from parents who don't necessarily, you know, buy into the whole OT realm, because when they look at you guys, they ask themselves, why is this adult playing with my kid? You know, they're supposed to be doing activities. They're supposed to be going through therapy. But for you guys, it's not just playing with the child. It's literally building up these various skills and occupations which that child needs, or possibly foundational cognitive skills which they may need within their life. So I might be misinterpreting this then. So open-ended play doesn't necessarily fall within any of those stages. It's just a very beneficial way to be able to develop the skills within a child.
I would say maybe it's, I'm not sure exactly where it falls in terms of development, but I think it's definitely a higher level skill. It's probably within more of that cooperative play and maybe associative play of of understanding those kind of imaginary concepts and problem solving, because part of open-ended play is understanding something has multiple uses and there's no right or wrong. And some kids who are very rigid in their thinking, they only see one use in an item. So that cognitive aspect of abstract thinking and is something very hard for a lot of kids. So it varies kind of within each child and their skill set. So
yeah, I agree with Alvin. It probably has to be if we were to pick which part of, you know, hierarchy this open-ended play would be, it would have to be under cooperative, because they do need that communication part and that social emotional aspect piece of like, oh, that could be something else. Like, it's not as rigid as, you know, as kids think it would be. Like, a train is a train, and that's it.
I can already see from the parents listening into this podcast, they might be a bit overwhelmed. You know, how exactly do I gauge what stage is my child at? How exactly can I facilitate this open-ended play without truly directing it? But there's so many things which need to balance, and that's a lot to put on a parent. So I'm just wondering if you guys have any tips or any ideas for toys or objects which you could recommend to parents which would help them facilitate that open-ended play and set their children up for success. Because I don't think you can just grab anything, but there are a lot of things you can grab at the same time.
In terms of open-ended play, the main benefit of open-ended play is that there is no right or wrong. There are toys specifically that I would say are closed-ended that has one purpose. But I really want to focus on the objects and the toys that have multiple purposes. So let's start at the basics. If you're outside, you can work with various different sticks, different types of rocks, pine cones. A lot of recycled material too is a great tool for open-ended play. So right now we're all ordering things from Amazon. So those boxes can easily be intertwined with play. Because if we think of kind of that Christmas morning when we have all these amazing gifts and the parents are setting it all up, putting all the batteries, putting it together. But at the end of the day, the kids are playing with the box. They're so amazed by these boxes because it's so new and so novel. And why is it so amazing? Because it provides a lot of that open-ended play. There's endless ideas that can come with it. So for parents to really just look at kind of the simple things. It's hard to, I need to get this toy, I need to get that toy. That toy helps facilitate this. But if we break things down, like wooden spoons or pots and pans from the kitchen, That can be drums. That can be a hat. It can be a basket for a picnic. So the basics of open-ended play are similar aspects to that. But if you're looking at simple toys, a lot of like blocks, a lot of wooden figures and dolls can kind of facilitate that open-endedness. And Play-Doh, we want to think of any item that has multiple use. And that's the most beneficial way to facilitate so many skills, even from a sensory aspect to fine motor development to problem solving and more executive functioning skills. So,
for you guys, what are the other benefits? Like, what are the rock hard benefits behind open-ended play? If you could put them into a list for all the parents listening into this podcast.
I think one of the biggest aspects of open-ended play is that executive functioning. I think that word kind of is thrown around a lot, and kind of that big idea of what executive functioning is really the problem solving, the ability to kind of create a plan during play and figuring out what's not working with the plan, how to execute that plan, and how to like modify that plan. So playing with new materials, playing with new tools like scissors, playing with glue and all those things to build your open-ended play really works on that executive functioning skills. And if we're looking at executive functioning as an adult, that's really like planning bills. It's doing all these higher level skills and facilitating all of that within kind of daily context. And we want kids to eventually get to that. But in terms of being a kid and being playful in that occupation, it's a good way to practice those skills. And it's also a good way to kind of build that mindset of getting better and understanding that things aren't always going to come out as you expect it. So there's a term that a lot of OTs use is growth mindset. So it's the ability to constantly learn and grow from their mistakes and get better. So that would help with frustration tolerance, and that would help with being able to cope and regulate when things are getting difficult and when they're getting frustrated with different things. So whether they're in school and they're getting frustrated with a test, or they're getting frustrated with an activity or a peer scenario or situation, they're being able to learn from those mistakes and being able to learn from the problems that they're doing and kind of learn from that experiences and get better from it.
Yeah. And I think going back to what you said earlier, how open-ended play should be X, Y, and Z. I need to correct you on that, because there is no X, Y, and Z in open play.
Yeah.
Because there's no right or wrong way of playing that. And since it is child driven, like, parents shouldn't be scared of, you know, to see what their kid knows or what they're thinking. And so just presenting them something and going with that could just be open at play in itself.
I think we've grown up in a society where we always want that regimented plan set place for us. You know, we always want to know that if I put in this, I'm going to get this. And that's why it's so hard sometimes for parents to get buy-in, or that's why it's so hard for you guys as OTs to get buy-in from parents, just because that path might be clear for you, but it might not be clear to the general public. And that's why you guys are on here. So we can communicate that. Something which stuck out to me, though, was going back to the whole stages of play and how open-ended play would most likely fall within the cooperative realm. That's assuming the child has the cognitive level to be able to understand what another person's feeling and is appropriately able to respond and react to what that individual is doing or how they feel or what they're saying. So that kind of goes into the social emotional aspect and social emotional development, I mean, within the child. Could you guys expand more on how that comes about within these children as they go throughout this process?
I think when we look at social emotional kind of development, there are so many aspects to what falls under social emotional development. There's a huge umbrella in terms of social emotional development, and many of those skills can be worked on and are identified under social emotional development, like regulation. Maybe a lot of kids may seek out that tactile input, and it may be calming and maybe relaxing for them. So having them identify maybe for a sensory box in particular, can be used to help calm and regulate our body. So identifying, ooh, when I'm angry, I can go play with my sensory box, or I can go play with some of my toys, because it takes that frustration away and it kind of goes to that playful thinking and that redirection. And when you're kind of incorporating play within with peers, there's a lot more social awareness that goes on with open-ended play. So understanding the social cues, maybe turn-taking, understanding rules, empathizing and understanding another person's perspective. When we talked about kids being really rigid, they might get rigid because that's a wrong idea. That's not right. Even though if we're working on open-ended play, there are 5 correct answers, but for one kid, my answer is correct. Nope. And then that can kind of lead to a meltdown or some frustration within that peer conflict or that peer situation. So social emotional skills is really a big umbrella, and it's really hard to focus on different one thing that kind of intertwines open-ended play, but I feel like that's a totally different podcast in itself.
Definitely. Yeah.
Well, another, you know, social emotional aspect about these sensory boxes is also about self-control. I mean, a lot of the fillers in our sensory boxes are not, you know, edible. practicing that self-control of not putting it in your mouth and keeping stuff in the box is another social emotional aspect that, you know, I feel like kids and parents, like, they need to work on it, but they don't know that they need to work on that, because sometimes it's just like, okay, just don't do it. But sometimes kids need that, you know, gradual exposure. Like, you know, here's this, you know, that marshmallow test where it's like, okay, don't touch it.
Oh yeah.
Slowly build up your self-control.
Yeah. That was just,
and that's
mean.
All based off of impulse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, okay. So to kind of reel things back, because you guys mentioned sensory boxes a lot, and it seems like sensory boxes can really enable that open-ended play. However, I'm not sure if the parents out there can truly understand what a sensory box truly is. So could you guys possibly give some insight as to what exactly comprises a sensory box?
Basically, it's a box that contains all these items that are, you know, beneficial for a child's development, but in plain simple terms, it's a container filled with fillers like rice, water beads, shredded paper, and tools such as like measuring cups, spoons, spatulas. Mm-hmm. And those, everything in the box are made to be transferable skills later on. Mm-hmm. So like pouring, measuring, spatial awareness. Mm-hmm. And with the sensory boxes, it provides that controlled environment where the kids can learn those skills.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And if we're looking at development too, the tactile sense is the first and foremost sense that we develop as babies. So we're really looking at facilitating those pathways to further develop those skills. So the more you're kind of exploring on your own, doing that independent play of everything around you, you're facilitating those neurons, kind of building those pathways so that other skills can be built upon. So when you're exploring with these sensory boxes, you're manipulating so many underlying skills in different areas where you can work on so many different skills, from fine motor to gross motor to, again, just that tactile input, because a lot of kids can be aversive to mm-hmm. some input. So these are kids who don't like touching glue, who don't like specific fabrics on their shirts or the tags on their shirts. So kind of desensitizing them to all the different tactile inputs throughout their everyday environment.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And children learn through their senses. Like what you mentioned earlier, when you were a little kid playing with that pine cone, you were pinching it, touching it, you know, throwing it, whatever. Mm-hmm. But actually, you were feeling it, how it feels through your feels on your fingers. You were probably, you know, making sure is it rough? Is it soft? Do I like the smell of it? Do I like touching it? And so within that sensory bin, that's kind of the same experience, but in more a controlled environment.
Do you have any examples for open-ended play, possibly, like, aside from cooking, when it comes to, you know, parent utilizing their own sensory box? How exactly would they interact with the toys or the objects within the box they made?
So I think in terms of interacting with the box itself, again, take their lead, see where they go. You don't want to, again, take that metaphor of driving the car. You don't want to drive it for them. See where it takes them. A game I really love to really practice this for parents is this game. Either it's called This Is Not a Box or This Is Not a Stick. So yeah, if you practice, if you're out in the backyard, grab a stick and you go, oh, this isn't a stick, this is a magic wand, and you kind of build on that experience so that they're gonna say, oh, we're gonna practice our magic words, or your you kind of explain your environment. So you're building upon that experience, and then maybe a few minutes later, oh, this isn't a stick, this is a carrot. And then you, oh, I'm gonna eat my carrot. You kind of share, oh, do you want to try it and whatnot? So practicing being able to follow their lead and build upon a certain action or a certain item of play and stay within that play schema is really good to practice. I think for parents, it's really hard to take their lead. You want to be like, oh, no, let's do this instead. Really stepping back is a really good way to understand where they are at their element and going for the ride with them. You don't want to just take full control of it. I think that's really hard. I think as an OT, that was hard for me to like, no, let's do this, rather than following their lead and incorporating what you want to do.
Interesting.
And I think also you mentioned the cause and effect for open-ended play. And if I were to, you know, pinpoint what the effect is from open-ended play, it would have the effect is the exchange of ideas, the exchange of creativity, the questions, and the thoughts. And that's what open-ended play is all about. That's the effect of it.
And there's also a way of, like, guiding the play and the conversation without taking a full lead on it, too. Say we're playing with boxes. The kid says, ooh, I want to play in a plane. And I want the kid to explain what's this plane, where is it going to go and whatnot. And you can kind of think, okay, you can question that, like, ooh, what does our plane need to get up in the air? How would we get up in the air? So then, oh, they would be able to figure out, oh, this plane needs some wings, because it's always better when kids figure out that answer themselves. They're connecting that pathway independently to get that answer. So then if they're doing that more rapidly and on their own, they can kind of come up with all those things much faster going forward. That's why I don't like to, you need wings on your plane, you need a steering wheel. You want them to come up with the answer. So guide them and have them problem solve with you. Ooh, what does your plane need to get up in the air? How would we drive that plane when we're up in the air? So simple questions like that is a really good way to kind of facilitate that thinking. So you're not directly giving them the answer as well.
And it's okay if, you know, if it didn't go as, you know, the parent plans or as OT's plan, because at the end of it, it's also helping with problem solving. Like, okay, so now that it didn't work, what should we do differently? And that ties into the problem solving, to the social emotional, all of it.
Yeah, because once kids are problem solving their play, they can begin to problem solve outside of play in peer situations when they have conflicts, in school situations. So I think it's really important for them to problem solve within play, within their most basic element.
I love that. I love how you guys are really pushing forth that role of being a follower. If a parent is trying to partake in open-ended play with their child, following their lead, letting them make the decisions, letting them, you know, pose the problems and possibly coming up with a solution to those problems, that only benefits them even more so, as opposed to you just trying to lay out the framework of what they need to do. And I think that's where a lot of parents might come short, just because it's hard for a parent to not take the lead when it comes to these activities. So with all the said and done, I get it. Well, we've given all the tips on what you guys, parents out there listening to this podcast, need to incorporate into your sensory box and what you need to do to be able to make the most out of it for your child's development and growth. However, it's a lot. And the reason why we're having this podcast is because we've actually partnered up with Alvin and Ivana on this podcast, and they're the owners of Sensational Connections. And you know what? I just want to open up the floor to you guys and let you guys talk about what exactly is Sensational Connections and why the hell have we been talking about sensory boxes for the past 40 minutes?
One of the reasons why we created these boxes and this company is because we've worked with a wide range of students. Our background is, we started off as school-based therapists. We worked with a lot of moderate to severe behavioral and physical students with physical disabilities. So we understand how beneficial toys are for these kids. And we've created and adapted so many toys for them. And we want to build upon that and find something that is purposeful and effective for therapists and parents. We know as parents that, yes, we can definitely go out and create our own sensory boxes by going to the dollar store and whatnot. But we wanted to save time for you and less of the burden of figuring out what's purposeful, what's beneficial, what works best for my kid. And we wanted to kind of create that. Our sensory boxes are hand-developed and made and curated based off of the developmental milestones that we want to facilitate. So
what are those milestones, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, so from just the simple fine motor milestones, from a simple grasp, we really try to facilitate that tripod grasp. So any way they can practice that within our tools for manipulation, and then a lot of the sensory milestones of being able to explore the different tactile input that we're presenting within our boxes. Each of our boxes are themed with a different theme. So from our spring collection, we had a spring garden, and then we had a camping box, and then we had an ocean box. And they were all different fillers with different types of tactile input. So one had water beads, one had beans, and was it rice? And then one had water beads. So it went from wet, dry, and snow. That's right. We had kind of polymer snow.
No, I love that though. And you see, again, it seems so simple when you see it on Pinterest, how to make your own sensory box. And it's just some random mom blog going over what you need to fill it up with. But I think the biggest piece which is missing is, what exactly do you do with those objects in there? So the fact that you're able to provide a theme that not only provides direction for the parent, but it also implicitly gives them like guardrails. I'm just wondering, do you guys put in instructions or possibly like summaries or booklets to spark that imagination within the parent so that they can conduct it for their child at home?
Yeah, so our sensory box, you know, the core standard is to focus on those core four skills of children's development, which is fine motor, gross motor, visual motor, and mindfulness. But each box also comes with an activity guide explaining, you know, a few activities for each of those milestones of development. Mm-hmm.
Could you possibly give an example from one of the sensory boxes? Oh, the one with snow. We'll use that one.
Okay. So that, the one with our snow, it's actually pretty awesome. You add water to it and it grows over 100 times its size. They're really tiny. And it,
what?
Yeah. It's polymer snow.
I didn't know that.
It's pretty awesome. But in that box, it's a camping box. So some of our open-ended items in that are sticks and twine and felt. And you want to build your own tent. So kind of wrapping the twine around the sticks is really fine motor development. It's creating that plan of how I want to build it. So if you're building like a teepee-style tent, if you're building kind of a standard triangular tent, like being able to problem solve that and build it is really all working on all of those fine motor skills, executive function skills, to visual perceptual skills of cutting and bilateral coordination. So we kind of structure it in that way. But then when you have everything set up, you can kind of work on how your wooden dolls are playing and manipulating through that place play environment that you're creating. And you can kind of create anything from the different felt and sticker items that we have, because you can make your own mountains, you can make your own river that flows through the snow in a way, but there's so many ways you can do it, which is great because we facilitated in that guide of really structured activities. But then we'd also talk about the different ways you can facilitate the open-endedness of it. There's a lot of opportunities for play.
Mm-hmm. Honestly, this is the reason why I love this collaboration, just because your approach to SensoryKit is a lot different from other individuals out there on the market. And the reason why I say it's a lot different is because so many things are happening in tandem with one another. It's not just this kit is for sensory stimulation. You know, I've seen that multiple times. For gosh sakes, like, we do the same thing at SensoMinds, you know? But with you guys, it's a much more holistic approach to child development. Like, I just had a very rudimentary idea as to what the benefits were behind your sensory box. You guys covered a lot of it, but you were going to build upon the whole idea of setting expectations and helping this child prep for their future and being able to transition into various events which will pose new challenges and new experiences for them, either from a sensory aspect or from a mentally cognitive aspect as well. So the question I have for you guys was, were these sensory boxes which you guys created made with that in mind? Where did the themes kind of come from? You know, how exactly did you come up with these sensory boxes? Just because not everybody can do that. You know, like, if you asked me to make my own sensory box, I would not be able to tell you what to put into it, what the theme would be, how exactly do I structure a story or some type of play around it. I would not be able to do that. Sorry.
Well, I think theming is part of what makes this unique. There are a lot of sensory boxes that you can make. You can pull random things, but the theming to what we've created builds upon play. So it already kind of creates that environment. It lets kids build upon that. And so building on that camping sensory box, we have like these wooden animal figures that they can draw on. There's I think 6 different wooden figures, and they can kind of create an animal's den within the woods while they are, while they're camping. So we're really looking at facilitating certain things within that time frame. So within our spring collection, we wanted to build a garden because that's what you do during the spring, or you go camping because it's starting to get nice out and you start to play outside. So we have that ocean box. In the works right now, we're working on having a summer wet and wild collection, where it's one, there's a pool that kids can play in with different items that they can play with within the pool. And we try to figure out what's playful and what fits within that time frame. So maybe in the fall, we might have a Halloween or Thanksgiving themed type of box. So it really depends on what's relevant now and what we think kids will play with, because internal motivation makes play and makes therapy a lot more motivating and purposeful.
I love that. I love how you're making the sensory boxes relevant to the child's circumstances based on what time of the year it is, what seasons are we in, what holidays are coming up, just because that modeling what you're doing for the child, or the modeling which they're doing for themselves almost throughout this open-ended play, is only going to benefit their overall growth and development and understanding of the world they live in as of now. And that just contributes to their overall sense of agency.
And with the time we are in today with COVID, like, this kind of started because of that. We wanted families to be able to have meaningful items while they're at home with their kids. So all our boxes really have that purpose. Like, you can still work on a lot of the fine motor stuff we can do in therapy through teletherapy. So it had a lot of that in the back of our heads of how can parents or how can other therapists pick up this between the computer and kind of work on different things therapeutically. So.
Mm-hmm. And I think it all started, you know, me and Alvin mentioned that we have that background working with moderate to severe autism, and we're just trying to make it more accessible to those parents, especially now during COVID, you know, having all these toys and items, but also creating it so that there's multiple purposes, so that it's meaningful and engageable in, you know, their daily activities, even though they're just at home.
Yeah, and we want parents to, we know their lives are busy. We want them to interact with their kids and play with their kids. So we wanted to take that burden of the time to plan and create something that's meaningful and purposeful and give that to them by presenting them with that box. So a lot of, when we work with families, they put a lot of trust in our skills. So I hope families put a lot of trust in our boxes and hope that it does facilitate those skills that we're working on within the therapy session. So
the thing I love about you guys is you've made play accessible. I think that's the only, like, that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to partner up with you guys. So there is a partnership between Sensual Minds and Sensational Connections. It's because you were able to make that whole aspect of exploration, you know, affordable, but also accessible. You've made a kit which is not only diverse, but it's also extremely adaptable based on what the child needs to do. I've seen so many times where, you know, you go through Instagram or Pinterest, you see a bunch of Montessori rooms, you see playrooms filled with toys, but because those toys are so close-ended, they only get one or two uses out of them, and you now have a cluttered room, as opposed to, as you guys were talking about earlier in this podcast, all you really need is rice in a box for a kid to have fun. You know, I don't mean to like simplify it to that, but it doesn't take much to stimulate a child's mind. It doesn't take much to entertain them. You just need to keep it open and help them take the lead. You know, you're essentially teaching them to take the lead in their own exploration of the world and making them more open to exploring the world through various means, whether that's acclimating them to various circumstances, or as you guys have said on multiple occasions, increasing their tactile exposure so that they're no longer tactile averse, or, you know, they avoid tactile senses, but they're now actively trying to see, okay, like, what does this feel like? Is this rough? Is this soft? That's the aspect I absolutely love about you guys.
And we wanted to make it accessible to all levels of students' performance, being that we've worked with a wide range of kids. We know that all toys don't work for a lot of our behavioral and more moderate to severe students because of their limitations. So simple items like this can be great for a 4 or 5 year old, but for it can also work for a 10 to 15 year old who's at that same developmental kind of age range cognitively. So when we see a lot of those Montessori pictures and those items on Instagram and Pinterest, it doesn't work for all ages. So I feel like this can be graded and adapted in so many ways that can go from more appropriate kind of neurotypical toddlers to more of the more moderate, severe kind of students and populations. So
definitely. Yeah. And just a little shameless plug. So within this collaboration between Sensual Minds and Sensational Connections, our sensory chew necklaces are integrated into your guys' sensory boxes. And instead of having me speak on it, I just wanted to hear from you guys, why exactly did you guys want those chew necklaces inside of your sensory box? What were the benefits behind that? And how exactly would that lend a child or support a child in terms of their journey of open-ended play, you know?
As OTs, we see everything as sensory, right? Mm-hmm. We see the main benefit of like sensory chewies. So a lot more kids may need a lot more input to kind of re-regulate and attend to different tasks. So a lot of parents might have heard the word proprioception, right? The proprioceptive system is within our joints and within our muscles, and it really provides a really calming and regulating neurotransmitter and really calms and really regulates the body. So what people don't realize is the jaw is really a strong joint, and it really provides a lot of that calming and relaxation that our body needs to re-regulate. So a lot of the chewies, it's a natural way for some kids to get that additional input. Sometimes a lot of my general ed kids give them some gum and they can get that same input, but some other kids need a lot more intense input. So that's when that chewy comes into play, and they're getting that input and they're engaging in an activity that is meaningful and purposeful, like our sensory boxes. So if they can attend to an activity independently during play, I feel like it goes hand in hand. So generalizing that within within play is the most basic way of working on attending in anything. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's important for, I mean, the first step I feel like for play also is that attention. If they're not attentive, then it's not, how is it going to play out, you know? And with the Chewies, it re-regulates them, their bodies, so that they can pay attention, so that they could process that information that they need to process, so they could, you know, interchange those ideas. Because without that, then it won't be as successful.
I love the way you guys put that.
I love the design of it, too. I mean, you can probably talk about, like, everything about it, but yeah.
You're just being nice, Alvin. You know? He's a sweetheart. Yeah, that pretty much wraps up this podcast. I'm just going to do a few shameless plugs, though, before we sign off, though. So do you guys have an Instagram where parents can follow you? And do you guys have a website where you can buy your sensory boxes? I'm just going to leave the floor open for you guys.
Of course. Yeah, you guys can check us out on Instagram and Facebook. We're under Sensational Connections. And then you can go to our website, sensationalconnections.com, and you can learn more about our core and our mission to help families and helping other therapists. And you can buy our boxes and check it out there.
How much are the boxes, if you don't mind me asking?
They range based off of the different items in it. So right now we have one for $35.99 and we have one for $40.
So yeah, you can check us out on Instagram and on Facebook under Sensational Connections. And then you can go directly to our website. Our website is sensationalconnections.com. There you can learn about our mission of how we want to help families and other therapists and our core four skills and what we're really facilitating within our sensory boxes as well. Right on our website, you can purchase our boxes. Our boxes individually range from $35 to $40. And then we're offering a pretty awesome bundle right now. If you buy a bundle of two, you save, I believe, about $10. And then if you buy a bundle of three, you save up to $15 to $20. And then just because you guys are listening to this podcast, we're offering you guys a special discount code. You can add SENSO10 to checkout, and then you guys will get 10% off. So definitely check that out. It's a great deal right now, and just for listening, you guys get that special sale. So thank you guys for checking that out.
You've just been tuned in to the Sensory Corner, a podcast surrounding all things sensory parenting and occupation related. As you've heard before, this is our very last episode for this season of the Sensory Corner, but don't worry, we'll be releasing a new season in coming weeks. We're just going to be spending a bit more time trying to connect with other companies to see if we can join forces and make a difference in the world. We truly want to be able to help support the sensory and special needs community and provide tools of which are not only useful, effective, but also therapeutic. So, in the meantime, if you guys need to satisfy your child's stimulatory or sensory needs, be sure to check out our website via www.sensominds.com. That's S-E-N-S-O-M-I-N-D-S. If you want to stay tuned with our podcast, be sure to give us a follow via Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever platform you're listening to. We do have a whole other library or plethora of episodes concerning sensory and stimulatory needs. So be sure to check those out in the meantime. Anyways, that's enough for me. My name is Mark. This is the Sensory Corner. Hope you guys enjoyed this. Goodbye.